Welcome to Clinical Conversations 119th podcast. It comes to you from Journal Watch, whose website is at jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. It's April 21st, 2011. I'm here with Dr. Danielle Scherer of Physicians First Watch and the Medical University of South Carolina. Our guest this week is Professor Ian R. Reed, the senior author on a BMJ paper examining the effect of calcium supplementation on cardiovascular risk. Dr. Reed's group re-examined data from the Women's Health Initiative study on calcium and vitamin D supplementation. The Women's Health study found no increased risk with calcium supplements. However, Reed noticed that about half the WHI participants were taking personal calcium supplements at randomization. He then used the WHI database and excluded data on women taking personal supplements, and found that randomization to the calcium and vitamin D arm was indeed associated with a significant, though modest, risk for cardiovascular events. Reed's group still wasn't done. Next, they incorporated the partial WHI data into a meta-analysis along with data from 8 other trials of calcium supplements. And voila, the increased risk remained. Dr. Reed is on the line to discuss all this from Auckland, New Zealand, where he is professor of medicine and endocrinology at the University of Auckland. Welcome, Dr. Reed.
Hello, great to be here.
I hope that was a fair description of your work.
No, very much so. I mean, this is a thread that started some years ago when we carried out a study in Auckland, a randomized controlled trial. And for that, we actually hypothesized that calcium might have beneficial effects on heart disease. In fact, when we analyzed the data from that trial, we found an adverse effect, and that led to a meta-analysis that we published last year in the BMJ of trials of calcium supplements alone, which again confirmed an increased cardiovascular risk. But the question that remained at the end of that meta-analysis was, why didn't the Women's Health Initiative find the same effect? And is it because it was a study of calcium plus vitamin D? Maybe vitamin D somehow neutralizes the adverse effect of calcium supplements on cardiovascular risk. And so the hypothesis that we examined in the WHI was exactly as you have set it out. It was set up before the data set was sent to us because we had to write an analysis plan and submit that to the NIH in order to obtain the data. And so we have addressed that specific question. And what we've found is that when you take out the people who are self-administering calcium and just look at the people who are calcium naive coming into the study and being started on calcium plus vitamin D, that we see exactly the same increase in cardiovascular risk that we had seen in our previous meta-analysis of about 12,000 people in clinical trials. And we've also, in this latest meta-analysis, added the other trial data that's available relating to the use of calcium plus vitamin D. So we now have meta-analyzed data on about 29,000 people, which is something more than 160,000 person years of observation. And we see a 25% increase in risk of heart attacks and about a 15% increase in risk of strokes.
And you estimate from all that that treating about 1,000 people with calcium or calcium plus vitamin D for 5 years, although you prevent about 3 fractures, unfortunately, it looks like you're causing 6 vascular events, either heart attacks or strokes. What sort of reaction have you had from that figure?
Well, I think most people are quite sobered by that figure because, of course, calcium is being used not because it makes people feel good. It's being used purely to prevent events. Mm-hmm. And what that analysis suggests is that, in fact, it's causing events. It may even be worse than that because that figure from this meta-analysis is from a fairly low-risk population. The average age in this meta-analysis is about 64 or 65. Mm-hmm. Meta-analysis we published last year, which was the people were a decade older, and so they were at higher risk of vascular events as well as being at higher risk of strokes. And what we found in that meta-analysis was that we caused over 30 adverse cardiovascular events, and we prevented about 20-something. So, again, the balance of risk and benefit was negative, but the numbers were rather higher, and so, therefore, the net negative effect was somewhat greater in older people.
when we summarized your findings earlier this week in Physicians First Watch, we also did a poll that asked how many of our readers usually recommend calcium supplements to their postmenopausal patients. And not too surprisingly, about two-thirds of them reported that they're currently recommending calcium and or vitamin D in this patient population. And, you know, obviously this is, you know, current standard practice, fairly widely endorsed. How do you foresee this new information playing out as far as incorporation into guideline recommendations for, you know, fracture populations?
I think people will gradually come to terms with this information, and I think they will have to change their practice. I think when you have a completely new concept such as this appearing, it takes a while for people to take it on board, and we certainly saw that when we published our first paper on the subject in the BMJ in 2008, and that was met with disbelief. Mm-hmm. The paper that we published, the meta-analysis we published last year in the BMJ, I think was taken much more seriously because it incorporated data from a number of different studies, and it showed great consistency across the major studies in that meta-analysis. But what a lot of people have said since then, who firmly believe that calcium had to be good for you because it's something that we've always taken almost as an article of faith, they clung to the Women's Health Initiative data and said, well, you know, we accept your meta-analysis, but the Women's Health Initiative says when you give it with vitamin D, it's okay. And so I think a number of people, particularly in North America, have not changed their practice since last year's paper came out for that very reason. I think what this does is it says, well, that's not really a sustainable argument anymore. The Women's Health Initiative obscured an effect that was there because of the widespread use of calcium in both groups in the study. Mm-hmm. So I think now people are going to have to say, well, look, on balance, this probably isn't in the best interests of our patients, and therefore we should be reappraising how we go about minimizing postmenopausal bone loss. Mm-hmm. I think the other points to make there are that calcium is not a particularly effective way of preventing osteoporotic fractures. As you said, if you treat 1,000 people for 5 years, you prevent only three fractures in total. Mm-hmm. So that's not a powerful or particularly effective intervention. And so I think we need to be looking at targeting pharmaceuticals that reduce fracture risk to those people who are at high risk and meet the conventional criteria for pharmaceutical treatment. I think also we need to note that the meta-analysis that we've just published only relates to calcium supplements. It doesn't relate to calcium in food. And the epidemiological data does not suggest there's any problem with calcium from food in relation to heart disease. So I think we need to be steering our patients towards getting their calcium requirement from the diet, and in those at very high risk, targeting pharmaceutical interventions to them.
The editorial that accompanied your paper, Professor Reed, struck a cautious note. You know, it says that selecting only the WHI participants who are not taking calcium supplements at randomization may have skewed the results. What's your reaction to that?
Yes, I find that a sort of a puzzling comment. As I said before, our hypothesis was set up beforehand. It was part of an analysis plan we submitted to the NIH and was approved by them before we received the data. Then we did the analysis. So we haven't gone through the WHI data and tried 50 different analyses to see which one would fit with our hypothesis. So it is a prospective analysis. Also, the criterion on which we've selected the people to include in the sub-analysis was a patient characteristic that was present at the time of randomization. So we're not looking at patients whose behavior has been affected by post-randomization events. And so therefore we think that the randomization and the 16,000 people we have included in the analysis from the WHI, the randomization is still valid. The groups, by all the measures of cardiovascular risk that we have in the database, are still comparable. So we think that is a valid analysis. Also, the editorial makes some other slightly puzzling comments by saying, well, if you look at clinical trials of osteoporosis therapies, therapy for osteoporosis reduces fracture risk, and actually quotes one of our own meta-analyses to support that statement. And we completely agree with that. But, of course, in those osteoporosis trials, Both groups are receiving calcium plus vitamin D, and so the reduction in mortality from use of an osteoporosis medication is related to that medication. It's got nothing to do with calcium and D. So we were sort of slightly surprised by some of the comments in the editorial. This data has been presented at major meetings in the last few months, including the American Society of Bone and Mineral Research at the end of last year. And in general, it's actually been taken very seriously, and I think will lead to a change in practice.
You mentioned some possible mechanisms under which calcium supplements could cause that increase in cardiovascular events. Could you briefly outline those for us?
Sure. The short answer, I guess, is we don't know how this works, mm-hmm. But there are several possibilities. Before talking about the possibilities, it's worth just commenting on the time course of the calcium effect on heart attacks and stroke. And when we look at the meta-analysis, we see that there is an increase in heart attack risk within the first few months, really, of randomization to calcium or placebo. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly well established at 1 year, though the two groups continue to move apart subsequently. For stroke risk, the increase is much later, and there's really no hint of it before 1 year, and then a gradual divergence of the group subsequently. Hmm. So, original hypothesis was that the increase in vascular risk probably just relates to calcium deposition in the blood vessel walls, and we think that may happen as a result of the sudden increase in blood calcium levels that follows ingestion of a calcium supplement. Quite different from what happens after you have a calcium-rich meal, where the calcium is absorbed very slowly and the blood calcium level hardly changes at all. And to support our belief that small changes in blood calcium can have adverse effects on cardiovascular risk, there's actually a very large epidemiological database showing that if you just look at normal populations, the people who have a serum calcium in the upper quintile or upper quartile of that normal range are more likely to have abdominal aortic calcification, they've got thicker carotid artery plaques, they're more likely to have myocardial infarctions or strokes, and they're more likely to die during follow-up than people whose calcium levels are in the lower half of the normal range. So high normal calcium doesn't seem to be good for cardiovascular risk. Hmm. It may be just a simple laying down of calcium in the arteries, but I think it's important to remember that the endothelial cells and the vascular smooth muscle cells in the artery wall have calcium-sensing receptors, and there's evidence, particularly say from the dialysis literature, that if you abruptly change serum calcium levels, as you can through changing the calcium content of the dialysate, that you get changes in the function and behavior of those arterial cells. Also, platelets have calcium-sensing receptors, and the abrupt change in risk following randomization suggests that this could be something related to stickiness of platelets or coagulability of blood. So we're working on those different possibilities at the moment in animal and laboratory studies, but we don't have a clear lead at the present time as to which one it is. There may be some parallels or information from the dialysis and pre-dialysis literature where it's been shown in renal failure patients not yet requiring dialysis, that randomization to calcium actually increases the rate of coronary artery calcification measured through CT scanning. So it may be a combination of those different mechanisms.
And so it sounds like you're doing more research into the mechanisms at this point then. And it also sounds like you're satisfied that you've proven the link between the adverse effect of calcium supplementation and
Well, I guess the ultimate proof is to set up a hypothesis and then to do a randomized controlled trial, and that's not an option that is available to us in this situation, because of course the hypothesis is one of harm, and you can't randomize people on the basis that the intervention you're offering them might do them harm. That would be like doing a randomized trial of smoking to prove once and for all that smoking causes lung cancer. Mm-hmm. So we think, in the absence of having that level of proof available to us, that meta-analysis of 29,000 people in about a dozen clinical trials is as good a data as we're ever going to have. So I think the likelihood is that if people have remaining doubts, there really isn't going to be the option of substantial new pieces of data, certainly from clinical trials, that are going to inform us. There aren't any very large-scale calcium studies underway at the present time. So it's not as though there's going to suddenly be a new women's health initiative coming along that can address this question. And even if small studies with a few hundred people in them, or even a few thousand, are added, they're not going to be big enough or have sufficient events to significantly impact on the results of this meta-analysis. So I think we have this big statement from the clinical trial arena. Obviously, there are things that can be done in laboratory research that can test this and possibly corroborate it. But I think for the most part, clinicians and patients are going to have to take this piece of information and make their decisions based on this rather than hoping that in 2 or 3 years' time, suddenly there's going to be a major new injection of information that will clarify things.
And so now that dietary calcium has become controversial based on a lot of your research, do you think we can at least take solace in the concept that dietary calcium does not appear to be associated with an increased risk in these vascular events?
Yes, I think just to correct what you said that dietary calcium has become controversial, but I think you mean supplemental.
I'm sorry, I meant calcium supplements, correct, yeah.
No, I think that's true. I mean, we don't have the same randomized controlled trials of dietary interventions because that sort of study is very, very difficult to do. But certainly if we just look cross-sectionally or prospectively at cohorts of people and their dietary calcium intake, there is no hint of an adverse effect in that observational data. Mm-hmm. And for sure, observational data always potentially is confounded, but I think we clearly have to have calcium coming into our body so that we can maintain our skeletons as well as our excitable tissues and so on. We've got to maintain blood calcium levels. So going calcium-free is absolutely not something that I'm suggesting. And all the dietary data suggests that dietary calcium intakes within the sort of standard ranges that populations normally display, 500 to 1,500 milligrams, does not seem to carry with it a cardiovascular risk. So I think we should be encouraging people to look to their diets. There are low-fat dairy products. There are other sources, vegetable sources of calcium, and I think that is the way to go. I think also we should be reminding ourselves that much of the world survives on calcium intakes of 300 to 400 milligrams a day, speaking of Africa and Asia, and does not seem to come to major harm. And so I'm not suggesting that we should back off to those sorts of levels, but I think 700 to 800 milligrams a day, which is the sort of calcium intake maintained by many postmenopausal women in Europe and in North America, is probably an achievable target with dietary modification, and that we don't need to resort to the calcium supplements, which were a good idea, except that they actually seem to carry more risk than benefit.
Excellent. This is absolutely fascinating work. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for your interest.
Yeah, thanks, Professor Reed. That will do it for Conversation 119. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Ador Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. For myself and Dr. Danielle Schurer, thanks for listening.